From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Hofstra University in suburban Hempstead, New York, had the attention of people around the country and around the world as it prepared to host the first in a series of three presidential debates between Republican Donald Trump and Democrat Hillary Clinton. Lester Holt, the moderator of the first debate, selected the topics for that debate: America's Direction, Achieving Prosperity, and Securing America, announced about a week ago, subject to possible change, he said, due to news developments in the interim period. Certainly Syria will be part of that discussion, it seems, based on the prominent role it's played in developments at the UN and elsewhere. For more on that, we spoke with our political analyst, Professor Tony Montero, from Philadelphia via Skype Monday. Professor Montero, it's going to be an interesting night tonight.
Well, it's expected to be fireworks. And, you know, this could be, and some people are expecting it to be, the culmination of the election. In other words, in a lot of ways, who will win on November 8th could be decided tonight because of the way that the polls are going and how Clinton is declining in the polls. And the other side of this is looming large is the issue of war and peace as the Obama administration pushes towards all-out confrontation with Russia diplomatically at the U.N. Yesterday, Sunday.
Yeah, talking about throwing them. They were talking about throwing them off the Security Council. They didn't even do that during the Cuban Missile Crisis.
Say that again, please.
They didn't even talk about throwing Russia off the U.N. Security Council the Cuban Missile Crisis. This is new stuff.
That's right. You know, just on the question of war with Russia, Hillary and Trump are on opposite ends. This cannot be lost on the two candidates, on the voting public, and certainly on the two candidates as they enter this debate. So, you know, as we have said, the issues driving this election year are the questions of war and peace and these international trade deals like the TPP and NAFTA. So here we are, and hopefully those issues can be paramount.
Now, Jill Stein, in an interview about a week and a half ago, and a couple times since, if I remember correctly, is referring to this election as a realignment, which is along the same lines that you've been saying for many months now, pointing to the movement of Republican officials to Clinton's campaign, Republican donors there too, some of the Democratic, you know, basically a schism in the Democratic constituency that more or less lines up with support for either Clinton or Sanders, or formerly for Sanders. Now, a lot of them just looking outside the Democratic Party after what happened, including Sanders, essentially his betrayal of them. How do you see it in terms of people looking at this debate, which is being presented as almost as a boxing match, but you know, when you're talking about World War III, when you're talking about you know, continuation and deepening of austerity for millions of people in the country here, you know, there should be some public policy discussion too, you'd think.
Yeah. Well, you know, you have the media and, of course, the corporate media is heavily favoring Clinton, and they're going to try to make this into a reality show type of thing where Clinton's personality, or what goes for her personality and her ability to answer in detail some questions will keep her even with Trump. I think from the standpoint of the media, most of them feel, the people who comment upon the media, that Trump goes into this with a serious advantage. However, they hope to keep Hillary even. But you see, the media is one thing. What is driving the thinking and consciousness of tens of millions of people is quite another thing. And the pundits, the pollsters, the media have gotten it wrong throughout this election cycle. And people are thinking in ways that they're not expected to think about the world. And they're looking at the Middle East. They're looking at Syria. They're looking at Clinton's history of supporting and calling for and still calling for regime change, Iraq, Libya, and now Syria. They're looking at the Obama administration clearly pushing for a big power confrontation with Russia. And then on the other side, through all of it, they cannot forget that Trump has said, and said it over and over again, he opposes regime change and nation building, i.e. intervention, including in Syria. He opposes war with Putin. He is therefore aligned with the feelings of the majority of the American people, including the majority of the U.S. military. I mean, you know, they talk about the stars aligning, but seldom have we had a candidate who almost from the very beginning on major issues, existential issues of humanity, is aligned with what the majority of people are thinking. And this is quite extraordinary. And as he says, his candidacy is a movement. It is not politics as usual. It is not, excuse me, confined to the Republican Party.
Yeah, we saw that in the Democratic Party, and we're seeing that in the numbers for the Libertarians and Greens as well. People are, their behavior has changed. It's measurable.
Right.
It's quantified.
That's right. And you know, the two big factors going forward, which should trouble the Clinton people, is, excuse me, the lack of enthusiasm for voting among African Americans and young people. Millennials are openly saying they're not going to be a part of this election on either side. Others are saying they're going to vote for a third party. The Clinton or Obama coalition is in deep crisis. And in fact, if this logic, if this pattern continues, we're looking at a Trump presidency.
Okay, so in terms of the foreign policy aspects of it, you know, the policy that Clinton espouses, we see being essentially laid out in practice, except for her screaming from the right that it's not enough with respect to Syria, for example. And it seems like the stage is being set there, by the way. They were, when they're talking about throwing Russia off the Security Council or as the taking away its veto power, what they're doing really is complaining about the fact that Russia and China, by the way, have repeatedly vetoed efforts by the United States to impose, to quote impose a no-fly zone, close quote, but actually to intervene militarily in Syria. That is a looming problem, and we're looking at both the implementation of it happening with Obama to spare Clinton the political damage from that. She can always say, this is what I was presented with. Also with the TPP, the same thing. They're making a lot of noise. Obama's running around to a lot of places trying to get that thing moving before January, really before November, maybe.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yes. Oh, yes. And you know, the New York Times, in its editorial, long editorial supporting Hillary Clinton, could not find any substantive justification for the public supporting Clinton. The only thing that they could basically say, although they say in the beginning of the editorial that just being against the other guy is not enough to justify supporting your candidate, i.e. Clinton, but they do just that.
Right.
They do just that. And if you read the editorial, they acknowledge that there's very little left of the Republican Party as a national political institution, which we have been saying for some time,
right,
and which is a positive outcome
right.
of this whole electoral cycle. The other thing is that they say that Clinton has the experience to tweak the system, not to change it.
Right.
Now, that to me points out how out of touch they are. The people are calling for change in the system,
right,
not tweaking the system.
Right.
Fundamental change. And I want to make a distinction, you know, for our left friends. There is a difference in change in the system and change of the system.
Mm.
People are calling for basic change in the system, away from war, away from austerity, away from these trade deals. They are not yet calling for change of the system, which would be a revolutionary thing, but they are not talking about tweaking the system as the New York Times suggests Hillary would be able to do. They're talking about some basic changes, and they're right that that Trump is not presenting the numbers of fundamental kind of programs to bring about that change. But what he reflects is their call for change. And I think at the end of the day, in this debate and in this election going forward, the candidate of change, however much he is flawed, will win the election because that's the sentiment of the people.
You know, the people that are endorsing Clinton are also conceding the fact that Trump represents an agency, you know, he's an agent of change. And but the change that they're talking about is a, you know, creating an overtly fascist, racist, Islamophobic, et cetera, America, that they say he's riding upon that sentiment and encouraging it and is going to loose it upon the nation. What do you think, first of all, about that, you know, intrinsically, and then how it relates to the other things like, well, radioactive vapor can't argue over policy at all?
Yeah. Well, you know, and there's certain things that are missing in the whole election debate. We have to remind ourselves that this is a election within a nation that has politically pretty much become an authoritarian security regime, that we are not talking about a full democratic process even in this election. So when you look at Trump, he is probably the best in terms of reflecting a lot of grassroots sentiment, the best that the bourgeois class, in the broad understanding of that, can put forward. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
As Hillary is among the best. They're both deeply flawed, but they represent a flawed and a class that is in crisis. And that's what we have to understand. That having been said, we have to see, now that we have a choice, a limited one as it is, who represents peace more or less? Who represents an approach to gangster organizations like ISIS, who are, at the end of the day, I think ISIS is a tool of the Saudis and the Israelis and American intelligence and the American military. What Trump says is that he will go after ISIS. He makes that clear over and over again. He will unite with Russia against ISIS. The world was better before the destabilization of the Middle East, before the chaos, intentional chaos created by the U.S. policy in that region. And he, in fact, traces the rise of ISIS to the Obama administration. And I think going forward, he might even identify the current situation in Syria, where the U.S. bombs the Syrian Arab army in coordination, it would seem, with ISIS, who then attacks that same position. So I think we're looking at a very clear a division here, and it is not small. It is huge when you connect all of the dots.
Yeah, you can't really minimize that particular fact about the obvious coordination of the U.S. airstrike with the ISIS offensive in, you know, in that particular battle. President Bashar al-Assad was interviewed last week about it, and he pointed out the fact that in order to conduct the assault that ISIS conducted, it required planning in advance in order to mobilize and position all of the assets that were used to then, you know, launch the attack. And so they had clearly prior knowledge, unless it was just a grand coincidence. And in fact, it could be that they weren't aware, but that the U.S. was aware that they had their forces in this particular position and could launch from there. And just brought the air attack on, which set it up.
That's right. And you know, you can't, we cannot be unmindful of the fact that in the week after that so-called coincidence of the bombing of the Syrian Arab army and ISIS attacking the same position right after the bombing ends, the week after, Ashton Carter, the Secretary of Defense, and General Dunford, the head of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, testified on in a Senate hearing, and the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff and Ash Carter called for what they described as a limited no-fly zone in Syria. And were forced to admit that that would bring us into a collision with the Russian Air Force in Syria. And the head of the Joint Chiefs of Staff said, and that would mean war with Russia. So they're looking at war with Russia. And when you take the behavior of Samantha Power in the Security Council and now calling for Russia to be kicked off of the Security Council, I mean, this is preparation for war at a level that we have not seen since 1962, and perhaps even worse than that.
Yeah.
And I don't know how anyone who has any understanding of world politics can be indifferent to this situation and not be able to see the role of Clinton and the forces around her and the forces supporting her in this whole situation.
You know, going back to the debate for this evening, there was all this positioning about the Clinton campaign essentially demanding that the moderator fact-check Donald Trump. The Trump campaign and the moderator, essentially, the sponsors of the debate, and a good part of the media, which I was surprised about, but I guess they're asserting their own interest, saying, hey, look, when you're in a debate, you're supposed to fact-check your opponent. And, you know, you've spent the good part of your life as a college professor and in particularly political science where and also out in the community at, you know, public meetings and such where policy is debated. And looking at all of that, maybe you could give us a little context just on, you know, what the norms are for people that debate.
Well, we're talking about standards of political and criteria of political discourse. And they apply within the debates and they apply within the general context of an election campaign. Now, we have known for almost 40 years that with attack ads and negative ads and all of that, that the criteria of political discourse in this country has gone into the sewer. There are very few standards. And so you're asking people who moderate these debates who are actually not that well schooled in managing contentious discourse. These are news readers,
right,
like the Lester Holt, who will be the moderator of this one. So how do they manage it? What are the criteria? There are no agreed upon criteria or standards. It will be, and it has been, and it cannot be anything but a free for all. That is the way these elections occur. That's why they're so long. We've been going through this for over a year and a half now. And everybody will breathe a sigh of relief when the damn thing is over.
For sure.
Thank God. You know what I'm saying?
Oh, yeah.
But, you know, don't all of a sudden hypocritically act like we have had such a high standard of political discourse in this country. And we know, even no matter what occurs in the debate, although I think this one might be one of the more significant ones in the last 60 years, no matter what happens, the fact of the matter is that political ads and money, of which the Clinton campaign has over $150 million just in its campaign for advertising, will spin all of this. So, especially from the standpoint of the corporate media and the Clintons and the ruling class, you know, they're looking beyond the debate to the spin, how it will be spun.
Right.
And I guess we should, too. But the criteria of political discourse is very, very low in this country.
You know, if you think about it, normally in a public discussion about policy, a lot of voices are heard, even within the constraints, say, of a city council meeting or something. You have a microphone that people one after another get to go up to. Maybe you have five or ten or however many people are on the council, when the mayor and the city manager, whatever, you know, coming at one person like 7 or 8 to 1, and they hold the gavel. You know, all of that, but at least there's an exchange, and it's a multipolar exchange. Here we have, first of all, not an honest broker in terms of the, you know, body politic. You have a private corporation that is essentially owned by the Democratic and Republican parties. You have a media that selects a moderator that the media itself is clearly biased. And this election, as in all elections, and so that bias is going to be reflected through the holding of the debate. But you've got limited voices, no Jill Stein, no Gary Johnson, no Monica Moorhead, no Gloria LaRiva, no anybody but Trump and Clinton. And, you know, for example, where the Trump campaign is perhaps trying to make this about jobs and peace, and the Clinton campaign is trying to make this a referendum on white supremacy, essentially. You know, there are a number of ways to get outside of that binary, like, for example, having a John Mubaraka talk about racism and, you know, point to Clinton and Trump and offer a critique of each. That is not going to happen. So within the limited constraints of the, you know, the rules of discourse here, and the environment you describe where, you know, it's not even about public policy. It's about some emotional response to, you know, the knockdown of the adversary. How exactly are we going to parse, you know, a path to the voting booth looking at this? And not us, perhaps, but in general, the electorate.
Well, I think the path to the election booth, the path November 8th has already been established. And you know, I think, and I guess I'm going a bit out on a limb, maybe not, because other commentators are saying this as well. I think it looks like a Trump win because his campaign is going up because it is touching and animating and creating enthusiasm among a large swath of people. And one of the big questions is who's going to come out to vote. And it's just too difficult for Clinton right now. She's felt to be untrustworthy, to be secretive, to be not telling the truth about almost everything that is significant, including her health. She is seen to be connected to a past of war and intervention. So if large parts of the electorate want change, and I would suggest the vast majority of the American people want change, Clinton cannot resituate herself, and her campaign cannot resituate her at this late date as the candidate of change. She is the candidate. And this is not just me or you saying this, but in the minds of people, and of course, the masses of people don't talk necessarily the way we talk about these things. Right. But there is a sense that she is the candidate of war. She is the candidate of the 1%. She is the candidate of corruption. She is the candidate of not telling the truth the way business is done among the elites. She is the candidate who, even though they say Trump will say anything, Clinton will say and do anything. And people sense that. So a lot of people, millennials and African Americans in particular, who should be, given all that is coming from the Clinton campaign and the corporate media, we should be frightened to death of Trump. But somehow they can't mobilize us on the basis of fear. And so that card is taken out of the Clinton playbook. So now she stands as Hillary Clinton on her own record. And that's what people are looking at, not at her in relationship to Trump. And she looks better than Trump. You know, but they're looking at her, and what they see is what they want changed
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.